coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the Curious Realm's official coverage of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference here in Denver, Colorado. I have the great pleasure of being joined by Don Rubin. He is one of the SOF board and also a former theater teacher. Don, this is a fascinating topic. I'm a theater geek myself. It's how I got into my career as an AV technician, was through tech theater. And how did you come to the point as let's just start with teaching. How did you come to a point of teaching theater to begin with?
Well, I was I started my career as an actor.
Okay.
I went to the famed High School of Performing Arts in New York City.
Oh, wow.
Fame and the TV series, mm-hmm. and the film and all that.
Yeah.
I didn't dance on cars, but I learned my acting techniques there. And then I found when I was very young, when I was still a teenager, that I enjoyed writing about theater as much as I enjoyed doing theater, and I found that writing about the theater had the possibility to get you paid more than performing
the theater. Being in the theater.
And so I wound up getting my graduate degrees. I wound up as a theater critic in New Haven, Connecticut for the New Haven Register.
Oh, wow.
In and around the Yale Drama School. I mean, a whole lot of things like that. And then I did my one of my graduate theses on the regional theaters, new movement all over the United States and Canada, looking at theater beyond New York, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And I was traveling to the regional theaters, and I met somebody by the name of Nathan Cohen, who was a critic for the Toronto Star, and that was Ernest Hemingway's paper. That's how I knew the Toronto Star. And there was so much new activity going on in Toronto that he invited me to come to Toronto as second critic. And as I was moving into Toronto, York University, a major university there, was starting a theater department. They wanted somebody to teach theater criticism. They wanted the best theater critic they could find, so they went to my friend Nathan Cohen, and Cohen said, "Oh, I'm not an academic, but I have this young guy who has his graduate degrees, and why don't you talk to him, and if you sure. hire him, I'll come in and do some lectures." So I started teaching theater and theater criticism and theater history, and I thought this was going to be a five-year gig, but I found I really enjoyed it. I was able to keep up my writing, publications, things like that. So that's how I wound up as a teacher, as a university professor, and I retired 3 or 4 years ago after teaching an authorship course for the last 4 years at York University.
Wow. And, you know, you brought up in there theater history. That was a class specifically at the university that I went to, and let's start getting into this controversy, especially when it comes to theater history. How did you come to the Shakespearean controversy and the authorship controversy to begin with, Don?
Well, I have to tell you, when I found out about it, I was a little bit pissed off.
Sure.
Why?
Most theater people I know are.
I had studied theater at the undergraduate and graduate level. I had been an actor. I worked at the Shakespeare Institute in Connecticut. I was somebody who had seen everything at the Stratford, Connecticut Shakespeare, the American Shakespeare Festival there.
Yeah, yeah.
My field was theater. I then was teaching. I was teaching Shakespeare, among other things. Nobody ever mentioned the authorship question to me. In all those years, I'm 200 years old now. It was in 2010, I guess, that for the first time I heard about the authorship question. My wife bought me for Christmas a copy of Margot Anderson's book, Shakespeare by Another Name.
Yep.
And I love biographies. I read this book, and I was stunned I said, there's a question about who Shakespeare was. Why did nobody in all these years ever mention it to me? Why was I teaching that it was this guy from Stratford named Shakespeare who had no education? Why did nobody say that to me?
Well, and you know, let's start there, because that is one of the first things that I bring up to anybody. Whenever they, because like I told you before, I come from a theater background. My wife is a theater major. All of my friends in college were theater majors. Typically, whenever I post an episode with Kathleen Children, like when I just posted with Earl, whenever I post about this topic, it normally elicits at least one very angry email or text from a friend that's like, hey, man, are you serious? Like, how can you even say this about Willie Shake? And it's like, well, you know, I don't know of too many common people like sons of cabbage farmers that were able to read and write in the 1600s. Let's just start there.
Yeah, well, if you look at the evidence, the evidence is very clear that whoever Shakespeare was, whoever Shakespeare was, he was an educated person.
Yes.
He had to have read hundreds of books in many languages, many books that were never translated.
That's right.
There are hundreds of references to the law, kind of in jokes that only lawyers would make. There are references to falconry, many references to falconry by somebody who ran falcons, who dealt with falcons. Falcons were very expensive, and to train them was very expensive. This was, again, an upper class kind of activity. Many mentions of war and soldiering, and one of the most puzzling things, he wrote 37 plays at least. Almost 13 of them are set in Italy. Now, we know you could not travel without having your name approved and being given a passport of some sort.
Sure.
So we know that this man from Stratford never left England. We know that. If you want to be in the Renaissance, you want to talk about Italy. It's cool. It's the place to be. It's whatever. So you write a play set in Italy. You show people eating pizza or pasta or whatever you want to do. You take some of the obvious things. You do one play. You do two. But 13 plays set in Verona, set all over Italy with very clear and obvious references. This man knew Italy.
Yeah.
So if he never left England and knew Italy that well, how did this happen?
Well, and not just that, but also the fact of knowing how, for instance, knowing how the Doges of Venice work and how that whole hierarchy operates, you would have had to have been somebody of at least some kind of noble passage or understanding to understand how even the kings of
Italy, or wherever.
I mean, all of them.
Also, there's huge connections to France. Love's Labour's Lost is set in France, set in the court in France. How did this commoner, at a time when if you had the wrong name and the wrong background, you couldn't move, how could this commoner know the French courts, the Italian courts, the English courts? Almost all the plays are set in the courts.
Yeah.
This would be impossible for a commoner. So you start there, and then you add in something really dumb. The man's name wasn't Shakespeare, the Stratford man. His name was Shakespeare. There's no medial E in the family name. All the records are Shakespeare. The signatures, there's six really shaky signatures that exist, and they were probably all done by a clerk because they're all verbal. Shakespeare with a G, or Shakespeare with an X, or Shakespeare with a K. But there was never a medial E to make it shake. It was in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust in England, which owns properties which allegedly were connected to Shakespeare, which is not true, they said, well, for purposes to make sure we solve this problem, let's call the man from Stratford Shakespeare. So Shakespeare was born in Stratford. But no, Shakespeare was a name on written plays.
Yeah.
Shakespeare was a name on legal documents. Shakespeare was the family name. No one in that family called themselves Shakespeare. Shakespeare, Shakespeare, Shakespeare versus Shakespeare. And if you look at it and you're looking for a pen name because you're an aristocrat and you're not supposed to have your name out there among the hoi polloi, you have a pen name and you hyphenate it. And a shaking spear. What a wonderful pen name for a writer.
Which was actually his jousting name as well. Edward De Vere's jousting name was the Shakespeare, the Spear Shaker.
And he was referred to as the Spear Shaker.
Yeah.
And on more than half the plays and all the references, it's hyphenated. And during that period, you had Mar Prelate and Coney Catcher and all of these hyphenated names, which were clear people were nervous about having their real name out there. This was a period of tremendous censorship. We like to think of Queen Elizabeth, you know, very open in this and that. Now, think of the court of Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
You know, if you cross your eyes wrong or look at him wrong, you're going to have your hand chopped off or your head chopped off. That was that period.
That is a very hugely historically point to bring up, Don, is the idea that any person, much less a commoner, could be able to poke fun at the royal court, be able to poke fun at the doges of Italy, the crowns of Scotland, anything like that, without facing repercussion.
Absolutely. So you put the work into a pseudonym. You make sure your name is not there. People knew who it was, but you had credible deniability here. Well, no, that's somebody else. It's not me. So to save yourself, to protect yourself, you used pen names. It was the golden age of pseudonyms. And also, it had to do with your aristocratic status. Books were not considered proper at that time. You could pass manuscript around to your friends of poetry, of something.
Yeah.
But you didn't deal with the hoi polloi. You weren't out trying to sell books. Well, that was really tasteless.
And let's explore that for a second, because it's not like they had Amazon Kindle printing or something like that. Even the means by which to have something printed, most of the time, and correct me if I'm wrong here, somebody who taught theater history, but the manuscripts that we have are assembled. It's not like everybody got like an entire script like we do now.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was so expensive. It was like, okay, so you're this character in part three. Yeah. Here's your five pages.
Yeah, two things here. Number one, if you went to buy a book, it was rarely covered. You just bought the loose pages. They were put together, and then you put your own cover on it.
Yeah, you had it
bound. Or you took five books, ran them together, and then had them bound. Yeah. Okay, so books were pages because paper was very expensive.
That's right.
Books were relatively expensive. Now, if you were in the theater and you had a play like Hamlet, which would run 5 hours if you had did the full script. Nobody does a full script. But you have all these characters. You couldn't give 30 characters or 20 characters a 200-page play. It was just too expensive.
Yeah, exactly.
So what they did, they created what they called historically sides. And the sides, and when I was a young actor, I worked from sides still, you would get, let's say, 10 pages or 15 pages.
You get your scene.
It would say you,
and
you would have your lines, and then it would say next to it, Q. You wouldn't even know who was saying it. It would say Q, and you wouldn't get the whole Q. You would get go to sleep. So you didn't know what they were saying before, but you knew your last three words would go to sleep. So when you heard go to sleep, that was your cue, and then you would say your next line. Yeah. And then if there was a distance between the next lines, there would be some dots, and then they'd do you and cue and cue.
Yeah, because it's much faster to memorize that.
Easier to memorize, but also cheaper publish.
Absolutely.
Actors right into the 1950s were working from sides. And if you're working in summer stock, even today, today, many times you don't get a script. You still get sides.
That's right. That's right. And a lot of people don't understand that. And when you're talking about specifically the assembly of the first folio, which is what most theater majors immediately go to, well, the folio, most of this handwriting in the folio doesn't match. We barely have complete scripts of most of the original works. Most of them are assembled from bits and pieces.
Yeah, absolutely right. And you know, I would just make one other point here. It was expensive for a family to have paper. It was expensive for a family to have pens. It was expensive for a family to have books. In the case of The Man from Stratford, the family was illiterate going back all the generations. And he never had his own daughter educated. She couldn't write. She signed with an X. His wife signed with an X. So they were functionally illiterate as well. And the children after that, most of them were illiterate. So what you have in the Stratford man's family is illiterate generation, illiterate next generation, illiterate next generation, the greatest writer in the history of the universe, and then illiterate the next generation. There's something a little weird about that.
There's something very out of place.
Very once again, curious.
How does it get to the point of the curriculum being given to a professor and this still being the case? Even with everything that we know now, even with forensic archaeology, even with the forensic uses that we're talking about in here, talking about art that was done at the time, things like that, all these period pieces, all these forensic parts that point, how does it get to the point of ending up in a literary book that teachers have, that it's still this, or that there's no controversy to begin with?
How do we pretend that this doesn't exist, that there's no authorship question? I mean, I guess that's really what you're asking. Because the Shakespeare industry has long been controlled by people who've made a living off Shakespeare. They write biographies, and there's hundreds of biographies out there, and we have like 28 facts, and they all point to a businessman from Stratford who never left Italy. So what we get, because people want to write a biography, who is this man? We want to know about him. So a scholar sits down and makes up a biography. Mark Twain once said, writing a biography of Shakespeare is like taking 12 bones and creating a 200-foot dinosaur.
Yeah.
So you take the 12 bones. One of the most interesting biographies by a Harvard professor, it starts out, "Let us imagine." And so instead of giving us real information about Shakespeare, we say, well, during this time, this is what people studied in school. So Shakespeare, not Shakespeare, but Shakespeare must have studied this. During this time, this is how people traveled, so he must have traveled. Because there are so many law references, he must have learned the law. And the plays, we know that this businessman from Stratford, born in 1564, died in 1616, had some connection to a theater company in London at some point. No one questions that.
Yeah.
But what they do is they then say, well, we have 37 plays, two gigantic poems like Venus and Adonis, 154 sonnets. We have to jam them into this guy's life. E.K. Chambers in the 1920s and 1930s tried to put a chronology to the Shakespeare plays.
Yeah.
He was a respected academic. And he said, however, I'm trying to date these plays within the life of the Stratford man. So probably he's not going to start writing before he's 20 or 25 or something. So if he's born in 1564, then it's going to be 1589 before we have his first writings. And he dies in 1616, so there can't be anything after 1616. Yeah. But that's not based on anything. We have no dates of when these plays were written. We know when they were first performed, for the most part, but we don't know when they were written. You write a play today, it may take you 5 years, 10 years to get it put on. The same thing there. Somebody kept writing and rewriting and rewriting. Hamlet probably took him 10 years, and there was an early version, maybe done for at the courts for Elizabeth. Then there was a rewritten version. Yeah. Then there was a version in 1599, and then another playwright comes along after 1604 and says, I'm going to add this and I'm going to do that. Actors are always adding things in. When is a play written? We don't know.
And that happens even now. Like, you're hard-pressed to go see Jekyll and Hyde and see the same performance next year. They remove songs.
Exactly,
they change songs.
Exactly.
These things change and move around in theater all the time.
As I said about Hamlet, it's 5 hours if you put the whole play on.
If you actually
so
put the
what
whole
you
thing,
see
yeah.
is a Hamlet. And we're seeing, as this organization here, as a group, we're seeing a Hamlet here in Denver. It's 3.5 hours, 3 hours and 20 minutes. Very interesting. What is this director throwing out? What are they not including? What are they including? And that's going to tell you about their interpretation of Hamlet.
Yeah. And that brings up a very poignant point, is the fact that the average person who does not understand theater history and doesn't understand the fact that Hamlet performed book to book, cover to cover, is 5.5 hours, they only know the Hamlet that they've seen.
And let me also just say one other thing about Hamlet. It's probably the most autobiographical play that the author ever wrote. I believe the author is the 17th Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere. Hamlet is about an aristocrat. Edward de Vere was an aristocrat, the oldest aristocrat in terms of earldoms and things. Mm. Most aristocrats in this period were the second Earl, the fourth Earl, the third Earl. He's the 17th Earl of Oxford. That family goes back to 1066, to William the Conqueror. Yeah. That's the family. So it's about an aristocrat, this play. It's about an aristocrat who marries, who is alleged to be in love with the daughter of the queen's Secretary of State, Polonius. Polonius says, oh, he loves my daughter. That's what's going on here. Edward de Vere married Elizabeth's Secretary of State's daughter. So there's the same kind of thing. He did not like his father-in-law, had all sorts of problems with his father-in-law, presented as Polonius. Very, very autobiographical play in many, many areas. Edward de Vere's father was mysteriously died when de Vere was 12. Supposedly somebody poisoned him.
Yeah.
Okay? In Hamlet, Hamlet's father comes back from the dead and said, I was poisoned. Continue here. If you're brought up to be a prince, as in Hamlet, and your father dies, who's supposed to be the next king?
Yeah.
It's supposed to be me. He comes back from studying philosophy at the University of Wittenberg, and his uncle is now the king, and his mother is now married to the uncle. This is all very curious. What is Hamlet's problem? Hamlet lost his kingdom.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
And Edward de Vere also lost his kingdom. He was one of Queen Elizabeth's favorites.
Yeah.
He supposedly, if you want to take even more controversy here, he supposedly had a child with her.
Oh.
And if they had a child, what would that child be when she dies? The next king of England.
Yeah.
Talk about the Earl of Southampton.
And,
I mean, it just...
And you know, when you're talking about especially a royal family that once again goes back to the time of First Crusades, things like that, you know, 1000s. Yes, even the idea of these things being commissioned as political propaganda to prop up the crown, to basically show what they are versus that, versus the other kingdoms, versus Scotland, versus the others.
The only thing I want to leave your audience with is this. No one knows for sure who wrote the plays of Shakespeare. They know that the man from Stratford didn't. And the more you look into this question, the more curious it gets.
That's right.
And that's why we're into this curious realm as we study this. There's a wonderful book. I urge people to read it if you're at all curious about this. It's by Elizabeth Winkler. It's a book that came out last year. Well worth reading. Simon & Schuster, Elizabeth Winkler. Look for the book. I think people will just be stunned when they find out what's really going on in this question.
That's right. It really does. It takes taking an old topic and looking at it with a new lens and an open mind, Dom, because as I normally say at the beginning of the show whenever I talk about this, if I was a DA after my research, and it doesn't take shovelfuls, it takes like a light troweling over the dirt to scrape off the fact that, like, wow, this is all circumstantial evidence. Like, I would not take the case. If I was a DA. Like, no way.
It's a fascinating question. I'm glad you're here at our conference.
Absolutely.
I'm glad you're asking these questions. You got lots of good people to keep asking them to.
Let everybody know where they can go to get involved, where they can go to sign the doubting petition if they are a doubter themselves, where they can go to find out more information about the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship.
All of these things are on websites, ShakespeareOxfordFellowship.org. There is a wonderful document online called the Declaration of Reasonable Doubt, and it's simply called doubtaboutwill.org. Go online, read that declaration. It says, we're puzzled why the evidence is all pointing away from the man from Stratford, and if you think that we make sense when we say it's pointing away from this person, please sign our document. We have over 5,000 signatories worldwide.
People many, like Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, absolutely. Major people, major academics, people from all over the world, a lot of lawyers who believe in evidence, a lot of scientists who believe in evidence.
A lot of doctors.
And a lot of theater people. Yep. You know who the most difficult people to convince are? English teachers.
Yep.
English professors.
Yes.
Because they've been brought up on this, and they're going to have to relearn a whole
it's
lot
a
of things.
It's harsh indoctrination.
Yeah.
And it's one of those, it's not like we are changing a law of physics. It's not like you will lose a PhD or your books will be unprinted.
Yep.
You know, it's still a hypothesis.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the idea, is to look at this as a hypothesis. Don, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
I greatly
appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us out.
We're delighted to be in your curious realm because we're in our curious realm.
Fantastic. Well, you are online checking out everything from the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can follow the links and join the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship yourself and become an Oxfordian like me. Stay tuned through these quick breaks. We'll be right back with our continuing coverage of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference right here in Denver, Colorado, right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Curious Realms continuing coverage of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference here in Denver, Colorado. We have the pleasure of being joined by researcher Roger Strickmatter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris.
Great you to were be here. Just giving a presentation a little while. Let's get into that presentation a little bit.
Okay, well, I have for a few years now been the editor of a series of books that the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship has been publishing on various aspects of the authorship question. We did two of what I hope will be a five-volume series on Edward de Vere's poetry. One of the standard arguments that you will hear frequently from Shakespeare professors is, well, first of all, they say there's no authorship question. Mm. And if you persist a little further, they say, well, it couldn't have been the Earl of Oxford. And their two favorite reasons are, they say that he died before some of the plays were written, and they say that he was an awful poet. He was a prolific, innovative, creative poet, especially in the 1570s. We regard those poems as essentially the juvenilia of Shakespeare. Traditional Shakespeare scholars don't really have any juvenilia. They start off with Rape of Lucrece and Venus and Adonis, published in the early 1590s, which are long, complex, extremely well-crafted literary documents that cannot possibly be the work of a novice poet. They're a work of a poet who has already put in any number of years on his craft. So the first books are about De Vere's poetry. And then we've done several others. Did a book on Shakespeare and the Law. Mm-hmm. And this is relevant because Shakespeare's knowledge of the law is very large. He uses numerous technical legal terms in ways that some of the best legal minds in Anglo-American history will tell us are routinely highly accurate, except when he is perhaps varying the legal concept, because after all, he's writing a drama. He's not writing a legal tract. So it has seemed to many people for a long time that whoever wrote the plays had a very solid grounding in law, which you don't get in Elizabethan England without first graduating from college and then going to the Inns of Court. So the question of Shakespeare's legal knowledge has always been inevitably wrapped up in the question of who actually wrote these plays and whether the traditional account that we're given is correct or not, because the man that we're told wrote these plays not only did not go to college, but had no association with the Inns of Court or sort of the legal community in Elizabethan London.
Sure.
We also recently have done a book on the Shakespeare First Folio. The First Folio is the collected works of Shakespeare, published in 1623. This is a posthumous publication, regardless of who you think the author was. And about half of the plays in it had never been published before.
Yeah. And, you know, let's revisit that first book real quick, because one of the things that is very interesting is that concept of an early poet. I wrote poetry myself for years and years, and yes, there is a progression that happens to you as an artist, whether you're a musician, whether it's stagecraft, you know, and it's fascinating, because I definitely had my very good friend Billy. We would quite literally sit just like this drinking coffee. He would be writing poetry. I'd be writing poetry. I don't think I ever, Roger, got rid of a page of poetry ever, no matter the scrap, whatever. It's somewhere in a folder. Mm-hmm. My buddy would write things and just tear them up and like burn them, throw them away. I don't know how he did it, but as a creator, I don't understand that, but I understand the idea of somebody evolving over time as a writer, somebody's skill and craft evolving over time as a writer. So let's explore the idea of do we have any other early works of who we know as Shakespeare?
Well, that's a great question. it turns out that the second best playwright in Elizabethan England was anonymous. There's a whole series of play quartos which have some connection, an unclear connection to Shakespeare, that appear anonymously. Some of those actually were collected and accepted as being by Shakespeare in the folio many years later. And then there's a whole other group that sort of hover in the purgatory of not having an author. Many of us believe that those plays are... So I told you that Edward de Vere's lyric poetry corresponds to his Shakespeare's Juvenalia in the world of poetry. Yes. I think these anonymous plays are function in the same way with respect to the development of his dramatic skill and his dramatic techniques. And this is related to the point I mentioned that people say, well, Edward de Vere, whose dates were 1550 to 1604, that he died before some of the plays were written. But the truth of the matter is, there is no chronology of the writing of the Shakespeare plays that is really independent of an assumption or premise about the life of the author. And the most honest Shakespeare scholars who've studied the chronology will admit this. They say this. They admit it. So what we have is we have a situation where there is very imperfect and incomplete data about all these plays.
Yeah.
And the assumption is frequently made that they must have been written a year or maybe at most 2 years before their earliest mention in the historical record. This is manifestly not true for any number of plays. What is also true, very clearly, is that at least some of these plays we have definitive evidence for long-delayed publication.
Why would that be?
Well, the interesting thing is that when you look at the plays by genre, the genre that has the most examples of plays that were delayed, I'll use As You Like It as an example. You Like It is registered in 1600, 3 years before the death of Queen Elizabeth, 4 years before the death of Edward de Vere. It's in the registration, it says, when he hath got sufficient authority for it, which is essentially a registration that is saying, okay, you paid your sixpence, you own the play, but the registration itself is not going to allow you to publish because somebody of greater authority has to sign off on this. So, As You Like It, registered 1600, apparently performed in 1603. That's the earliest performance date we have for it. That is contested, but I believe that that is real. I think that's a true data point. But it's not published until 1623.
Fascinating.
So indeed, I would, with respect, bounce your question back to those who would defend the traditional view. First of all, you know, they have said repeatedly, oh, ha, 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 it's so silly. The Oxfordians say that these plays were kept in a trunk for 20 years. They were kept in a trunk for 20 years, at least a number of them.
Yeah.
Obviously and unambiguously were kept in somebody's trunk somewhere for many years. I would say that the reason the comedies have a particular problem with being published is just simple censorship. We all know that comedy, what do we say about comedy? You had to be there.
Yeah.
That means that comedy in its origin, however much it may escape that and aspire to universality, is about specific people and circumstances and time.
It's details.
It's details. And also it's details about real people who are being made fun of. Now, the being made fun of may be gentle or it may be harsh.
Yeah.
And in Shakespeare, I believe it is both, depending upon where you look. But Oxfordians, in my experience, are much better. That is, people who believe that Edward de Vere wrote the plays are much better than our Orthodox brethren at identifying what some of those comic problems are.
Sure.
And they relate to people who we know that Edward de Vere, the real author of the plays, had personal beefs with. So it's not surprising to see him taking out those beefs by writing comedies. And so these people are alive, their relatives are alive, And so some of those plays really could not be published until, well, I'll give you my favorite example. In Twelfth Night, Sir Andrew Augucheek is a pretty clear parody of Sir Philip Sidney. Sir Philip Sidney is a national hero in Elizabethan England. There is nobody who is more worshipped by the Protestant community in England than Sir Philip Sidney. And he's an intellectual, and he wrote a book in defense of poetry and wrote his own poetry. He's a very interesting man. But everyone knows who studies the period that he and the Earl of Oxford had serious beefs. It began when they were young because Sir Philip Sidney was engaged to be married to Anne Cecil. And then when William Cecil, her father, found out that maybe he could marry him to Edward de Vere, that was called off, and she married Edward de Vere. That was kind of maybe the beginning of what had been a friendship turning into kind of a personal rivalry. So this is a bitter mockery of a famous man loved by so many. The folio was published in 1623. What's interesting is that Philip Sidney's sister, Mary Sidney, lived until 1621.
Oh.
And it's her two sons, William and Philip Herbert, Earls of Pembroke and Montgomery, who are the two noble patrons of the Shakespeare First Folio. One of them, the younger brother Montgomery, was married to Edward de Vere's daughter Susan. The other one, the elder brother William, was at one time engaged to marry another of Edward de Vere's daughters. So as longtime researcher Ruth Lloyd Miller has said, the First Folio was a family affair.
Mm.
And like any family, it was a family with conflicted interests. Mary Sidney would not have approved of the publication of plays that mocked her famous brother.
Well, and, you know, specifically, especially the callback to comedy, like you were saying, the funniest jokes are inside jokes. The funniest jokes are ones that you were in on or that you know the situation.
Right.
So, yeah, when you're talking about these things being sometimes possibly commissioned as, political prop-up for the crown,
yes,
things like that, you would have had to have been in the know. You couldn't have been an outsider,
yes,
and written that joke.
Yes, and the traditional myth that we're told by the Shakespeare scholars is all these plays were written for the public stage. Nonsense.
Yes.
Some of them were written for the public stage, especially
I think they ended up there.
They all ended up there sooner or later.
Yeah.
But again, we could make a distinguish by genre is that the comedies tended to be written for more of a select audience.
Yeah.
And only over time did they kind of escape that.
Yeah.
But there's lots of evidence for this kind of conflict. Another really good example is Troilus and Cressida. Troilus and Cressida is one of the strangest plays in the Shakespeare canon because Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote essays on all or almost all the Shakespeare plays, says he ran away from Troilus and Cressida because all the characters in it seem to have gone to a medieval university. It's a deeply erudite, intellectual retelling of this ancient story of the fall of Troy and the relationship between Troilus and Cressida. That's another play that is registered in 1603, When He Hath Got Sufficient Authority for it. Now, it finally does appear 6 years later in a quarto version. That the quarto is a small book with just one play in it. But it's wild because there's only one quarto in 1609, but it exists in two different versions. Bibliographers call these two states. And the first state was interrupted, and the first pages of it, the title page, was torn out. A new title page was put in it with an introduction. And all of this stuff, I don't want to get too far into the weeds.
That's okay.
On this,
it's okay.
But the point is that there was real problems with this play for the kind of reasons that we've been talking about.
Well, I mean, the thing is, what the audience needs to understand is translations did not exist. at that point.
Mostly, correct.
It's not like you could go to the public library and pull out a copy of The Fall of Troy and read it. You would have had to have read that in the original Greek, in the original Latin, in the original whatever language it was, which once again bears the fact of an educated person wrote this. Somebody who was able to read the original text and translate it into a modern time.
Correct.
And into a modern situation.
Correct. And that has been obscured for centuries, really, because of a statement that Ben Jonson, as a younger colleague of Shakespeare's, in the first folio, Jonson has a long 80-line encomium poem of praise to Shakespeare. Mm. And it contains the line, "And though thou hadst small Latin and less Greek, for names to praise you I would not seek." And then he goes on to name a bunch of classical dramatists. Mm. And this has been misunderstood to mean that Ben Jonson is saying that Shakespeare has small Latin and less Greek. It's actually the opposite of that. If you've studied even a little bit of either one of those languages, you may encounter something called a contrary to fact hypothetical statement, which is what this is. He's saying even if you had small Latin and less Greek, but you don't, you actually have a lot, I would still praise you by comparison to those ancient Greek and Latin dramatists.
Yes. Yeah, it's a shorthand for if this, then.
Correct.
And, you know, that brings up a fascinating point. I myself am an Oxfordian. I'm a big believer in Edward de Vere, but there are so many. I mean, good God, I watch it. Curse of Oak Island. That's one of the hypotheses of Oak Island, is that the missing Shakespeare manuscripts are in the bottom of Oak. I don't know why
but
you would have to
find anything now.
Shakespeare manuscripts in the bottom of Oak Island.
Right.
But it goes to Francis Bacon. It goes to Marlowe. Where do all of these come from? Where do all of these possible authorship hypotheses source from?
Okay, then again, very good question. I would say that the wide diversity of people that have been proposed, and it's actually as many as like over 70 possible candidates, I think this indicates the depth of public discontent with the traditional account, which is wholly justified in my opinion. Mm. However, in my reading of the intellectual history of the dispute, really starting in 1920 when John Thomas Lowney first proposed that Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford, was the real author, I believe that theory has ever since then been by far and away more persuasive than the other theories. But, you know, lots of people actually knew about the reality, A, that there was an authorship question, and many people knew that it was Edward de Vere. But you were not to speak about it in public. It was just not done. You didn't write about it openly. If you knew about it, you wrote about it covertly, using, they had many very sophisticated techniques for sort of speaking in tongues about subjects that you were not supposed to speak about openly.
And you know, especially the way that, like you were talking about, or like we spoke about earlier, the idea that he ended up going with somebody else's fiance, the fact that his family goes back to the 1000s. You're talking about a lot of intermarriage within royal families, things like that. So the idea of his family going back so far, him possibly marrying into the royal family, you could possibly see how for a while you might want to obscure that fact of authorship, you know, to make sure that 3-4 generations down the line, somebody's castle doesn't get taken because somebody finds out, like, oh, you wrote that thing about my uncle? Your uncle wrote that about my uncle? Your parcel is gone. No more vassals for you.
Exactly so. And, you know, I think there are people, you know, view this very anachronistically. We're like, well, why wouldn't Shakespeare want to take credit for what he wrote? I mean, and yet what we don't realize is a couple of layers. We already talked about the politically explosive character, potentially the dramas. Yeah. And I believe that's a significant part of it. But there's also something called the stigma of print, which is essentially the idea that aristocrats were not supposed to soil their hands with doing work for money.
Yeah.
And that included writing plays or acting. It did not include, by the way, being the patron of a dramatic troupe. And in fact, the way that the Elizabethan state and also the Jacobean state after it operated was that you could not be an actor unless you wore the livery of a nobleman. Mm. And that was the way the state could enforce policy against actors who might... well, Hamlet has a thing where he says, don't to the comic actors, don't say anything that's not written down for you. That's what that's about.
Yeah.
Don't go beyond your prerogative or you're going to get in trouble. And the way the trouble's going to happen is going to come down through the noble patron.
Yeah, through the chain of command in that kind of way.
Right. Right. And so there are multiple reasons why the author of these plays actually capitulated, is the word I would use, to him basically being erased from history.
Be faceless, yes. And even the idea of he himself was patroned by the crown. The fact that Edward de Vere's got what would equivalent to now like $1 million a year endowment. From
correct.
The crown.
Correct.
And yes, he was a patron. It was great to be a patron of the arts. But you couldn't be the one writing the plays. What are you doing?
And I agree. When I speak about Orthodox Shakespeare scholars, I'm critical of many of their assumptions, but I've learned a tremendous amount from them. They're completely correct when they say that whoever wrote these plays was an actor.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's a whole nother layer of scandal. Is that's in some ways even worse, is that this is we're talking about a noble playwright who, in my opinion, I cannot imagine, we don't have definitive proof of this, I cannot imagine that he did not enjoy dressing up in women's clothes. Why would I say that? Because this is a playwright who's a male playwright, I believe, but one whose understanding of female psychology is extraordinary.
It's fantastic. It's incredible.
He has to have been deeply in touch with his own feminine side. And this is would have been terrifically scandalous.
Yeah.
We're talking about an England that is divided by religion, and there is a strong anti-theatrical sentiment coming from both sides, both from the Puritan side and from the Catholic side as well. The town council in London, the aldermen, whenever they had a pretext, like if there was plague in London, but it wasn't really, I mean, there was a public health rationale when there was plague to shut down the theater, but it's beyond that. It's like they wanted an excuse to shut the theater down. And when you read the documents of control of the theater, what you see over and over again is that the aldermen will shut down the theater, and then Queen Elizabeth will say, well, they have to practice because they're going to perform before me next week, so you should open up the public stage. That dynamic goes back and forth.
Yeah.
She was a powerful supporter of the theater in general, maybe not in certain particular cases, but as a general principle. And as you mentioned, one of the really interesting things about Edward de Vere's biography is that starting in June of 1586, in June of 1586, which was the year in which the Elizabethan state reorganized its censorship laws, and this was one part of that reorganization, the Queen authorized under a Privy Seal warrant, which is means that this is essentially an intelligence service level document.
Need to know basis.
Yeah, which literally says that the grantee, neither the grantee nor any of his heirs shall ever be required to account for the expenditure of these monies. She began to give him £1,000 a year. At the same time, the state's expense through the Office of Revels declines by approximately the same amount of money.
Wow.
So it's very clear that what she was doing was essentially contracting out to Edward de Vere the responsibility for basically funding the greater part of the Elizabethan theater.
Yeah, at least the private creation of things that, once again, may have eventually ended up in the public domain, though they were for the court originally, for their entertainment. Like, once again, absolutely an inside joke. Let's perform this thing for the audience that it was written for.
Yes.
And then it ended up going to the public theater.
I would say what you just described matches the comedies perfectly, but I would say that there's another aspect to it, which is that the history plays were intended for the public theater. Why? Well, 1586 is an interesting moment in time because that's only 2 years before Spain launches the Armada against England, and they knew this was going to happen. They needed to stir the patriotism of the English public. And a number of these plays, especially think of a play like Henry V, for example, is probably the most obvious example. That Agincourt Day speech is the ultimate of rousing.
St. Crispin's Day.
The rousing of a sense of national consciousness in defense of the English way of life. So I think it was both the subsidies supported both comedies on a more private level and some of these other plays that were expressions. They were not, this is a hard thing to say, so they were propaganda expressions of the Elizabethan state's intention, but never reductively so, because we're talking about a creative genius who was a disruptor, and so he actually makes jokes about this in the plays. In Comedy of Errors, there's this, the two Dromios, one of them says, I buy £1,000 a year, I buy a rope. Well, the word buy is a little bit of, you know, that doesn't sound like he's being given £1,000. But when you see that there's a rope attached to the £1,000, that's what it is.
Yeah.
He's joking about the £1,000 and talking about it as a rope. And in the sonnets,
holding him back.
Yeah. And the sonnets, the line is public means, which public manners breeds. The sonnet writer is complaining about public means, which public manners breeds. Now, that is a line that our Orthodox colleagues have no clue what it can possibly mean. But to us, it is a direct poetic reference to the £1,000 annuity.
Wow.
And the fact that which public manners breeds, that's the rope, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And you know, once again, the idea of keeping this secret for generations so that inheritances wouldn't be taken, properties wouldn't be taken, things like that. Why continue it? Why continue it now, Roger?
Well, of course, that's a very good question. And I think it's still a political issue. I think the character of the politics has been transformed over time. Mm. You have had since 1767, when the first Stratford Jubilee was held by David Garrick in Stratford upon Avon, you have had the development of a multi-$100 million tourist industry.
Yeah.
With huge real estate holdings in and around Stratford and the need to keep the tourists coming in. And then on top of that, you have, maybe around 3,000 Shakespeare professors in the world. And although their livelihood is not really threatened our heresy at all, I don't even think that Stratford upon Avon is threatened by our heresy, although that is dependent on their response to the challenge, right? Yeah. I don't think it need to affect any of that, but people think that it does. And, you know, I sympathize. I know that if you're trained for years, you go to graduate school, and you're told that this is not a topic that responsible scholars talk about, then you will avoid it. And unfortunately, the result is a huge information gap now.
That's right.
I believe in my lifetime, I've been involved in this for about 30 years.
Wow.
And the volume of new evidence that has been produced is absolutely staggering.
It is.
It's staggering. And yet, our Orthodox colleagues, for the most part, know virtually nothing about it.
Well, and I think a lot of that is because, you know, while they look at very traditional research, reading techniques, breaking it down within the culture of the time somewhat, which is odd to me because there are things like, really, a common person in the 1600s could just write like that? I don't think so. Not the way it was at all. But...
Well, especially when you look at the content of the works.
Yeah.
The most common noun in the whole Shakespeare canon is the word Lord. Yeah. And that's not the Lord in the religious sense. It's the Lord in a social sense.
Yeah, in the vassal sense.
Yeah, there's no question that these plays reflect a worldview that is distinctly aristocratic.
Yeah.
And that being the case, if you really believe that upwardly mobile, highly successful, petty bourgeois, he's not a peasant. Sometimes people, you know, like, no, that's not right. He was a very successful man financially, but he may have gone to the Stratford Grammar School, but even that cannot be proved. He didn't go to college. He didn't go to the Inns of Court. He didn't travel. And he certainly was, John Thomas Lowney said it best in Shakespeare Identified as Edward de Vere in 1920. Mm. He said, anybody who follows Shakespeare's advice about money will soon be in bankruptcy proceeding. Yes. Because Shakespeare's beliefs about money are
totally
not
unrealistic
that you require, especially if you're trying to save money to get ahead in the business world.
Yeah.
His attitude about money is very much the noblesse oblige, you know, to give it away.
You got to spend money to make money.
Well, and he believed he was anachronistically a believer in charity, in good works, and again, that fingerprint matches de Vere in very precise ways. There are multiple accounts of his excessive generosity. And I shouldn't say excessive, but the reason I say that is because it's also clear that he was not a good money manager, and he was born an incredibly wealthy man. He lost money his whole life. That's not what he was interested in.
Yeah.
He wanted to fund the arts and be an artist and to support other people in making art. And so he frequently ran into financial problems and literally spent most of his life selling off his inherited properties in order to keep himself afloat financially. Mm. Now, the one thing I should add to that that's important to realize is this is a man who, when he was 12 years old, his father died. And therefore, he became what's called a ward of the court, which means that his vast estates were managed by government bureaucrats. And he was 12 years old. He did not escape from the financial obligations that he incurred through his wardship until he was probably around 30 years old. And so imagine this. If you're managing this young nobleman, he's 12 or 13 years old, and you're getting a percentage of everything that he spends, you are not going to raise him to be spendthrift, you know, or to be economical. You're gonna encourage him to spend money. So that's the kind of financial training he had in his teens when he was being told that he had so much it would never run out. Ha ha.
Well, and you know, that's an interesting point to bring up, the idea of him being brought up by somebody other than his family. Because he was brought up by his uncle, correct?
Well, not quite. Although his uncle, Arthur Golding, was his Latin tutor. That's the connection.
And also a publisher.
Well, he was also the main manager of the De Vere estates. So it is really complex relationships. But the household that he lived in was run by William Cecil, otherwise known as Lord Burleigh. Now, William Cecil is a very remarkable man. He became the most powerful man in Elizabeth's government. His enemies called him King Cecil. That's how powerful he was. And he obtained that power by, as a young lawyer at about, I think he was about 30, in 1548, Princess Elizabeth, not yet queen, she was involved in a sexual scandal because her protector, who was married, she was living in his household, and the evidence shows that he was doing everything he could to jump her bones because that would put him in a politically advantageous situation.
Absolutely.
It appears that she became pregnant, and she was not seen for a number of months, and when she returned to court, it was William Cecil who put on the show that brought her back. And the first thing she did 2 years later, no, it would have been 5 years later, 1553, when she came to the throne, she said, "Send me William Cecil." And he became her principal secretary. He became the Lord Treasurer of the realm. And he became the in loco parentis authority raising the young Earl of Oxford after his father died in 1562.
Wow.
So it was in his household that the young Edward de Vere would have received an education. He had the best tutors available in England, Arthur Golding in Latin, Noel, can't remember Noel's first name right now, but Noel in Anglo-Saxon. Noel owned the Beowulf manuscript.
Oh, wow.
And we have a fascinating letter from him with, I think it's in 1563 when de Vere was 13 years old. He writes to Burley and says, "I can see that my work for the Earl of Oxford will no longer be required." Now, one might interpret that in many ways. I've heard somebody say, well, you know, he wanted to get rid of the kid because he was such a badass. But more likely, it was that he had already mastered Anglo-Saxon at the age of 13. All of the evidence suggests that he was a genius in languages, and he brought multilingual awareness. You mentioned, you know, being able to read Greek and Latin.
Yeah.
He read Italian. He wrote French by the time he was 12 years old. Believe if he knew Anglo-Saxon, he could have done German pretty easily as well. So he was really steeped in the same kind of cultural preparation that lies behind the plays.
Yeah.
And Cecil, he and William Cecil had a very complicated relationship. They were both geniuses, but of opposite spectrum. You know, Cecil was a genius at statecraft and the founder of the modern Secret Service through his friend Francis Walsingham. Very practical. It's sometimes said, well, he didn't approve of the theater. That's not really true. He did approve of theater, but it had to be in the interests of the political stability
of
the realm.
That's right.
If it didn't have that didactic purpose, he didn't approve of it. And of course, de Vere didn't care about that. That was, I won't say he didn't care about it. I think he remained certainly loyal to Queen Elizabeth, but he had other larger considerations than that.
Yeah.
He knew he was hell on wheels. He knew that. He knew that he was a world historical genius. He wasn't dumb. He could figure that out. And if you read the sonnets, I would really encourage your listeners to read the sonnets and especially pay attention to the sequence between Sonnet 71 and Sonnet 76, because he really tells you the whole story in those sonnets. He tells you that the writer says that his name has been taken from him, and he says that he tells his readers, don't rehearse my name when you read this. Don't say my name, because the wise world, as he puts it, the wise world will look into your moan and mock you with me after I am gone. I can't for the life of me see what traditional Shakespeareans can make of that, which may explain why those are not sonnets that they regularly expose their students to. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? That's fine.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, if you didn't understand the story of his connection, of De Vere's connection, and the fact that De Vere may be the author, then it would be utterly nebulous.
Correct.
What's being spoken about.
Correct. And one can go beyond that even as an Oxfordian. His motto was vero nihil verius, which means nothing truer than the truth. There are, if you again read the sonnets, and within that group that I described, I'm sorry I can't do them from heart. I'm not
that good
at memorizing things, but he rings multiple changes on that De Vere family motto in those sonnets.
Mm.
He's alluding to it in the language that he uses. You know, I said that he capitulated. He did capitulate. Here's an interesting example of why he capitulated. So I was able to study Edward de Vere's Geneva Bible, which is at the Folger Shakespeare Library today. It was purchased by Henry Clay Folger in 1925. One of the big lies in the modern Shakespeare industry is that Henry Clay Folger, although they admit he was at one time interested in the authorship question, and he collected Baconian books and stuff on Bacon as the author, and they say, well, he gave that up. He was no longer interested in it. Yeah. But the truth is he continued his interest, but he shifted his focus to Edward de Vere in the mid to late 20s. And I think he died around 1928. So just a few years after he purchased this Bible. So it turns out that there are over 1,000 underlined, marked, and annotated passages in Edward de Vere's Geneva Bible. It is bound with his coat of arms. There is no disputing that it originally was his. That is what Henry Clay Folger bought it as Edward de Vere's Geneva Bible. And one of the annotation patterns in it is in Matthew 6:1-4, which essentially says, this is some Jesus' rebuke to the Pharisees, and he says, when you give your alms and you do your works, do not blow your trumpet in the marketplace. So this was a religious precedent. It was used actually by William Tyndale. When William Tyndale translated the Bible into English for the first time, he did not put his name on the translation.
Yeah.
And this was contrary to the statutes of Henry VIII, which said that any translation had to have the translator's name. Why? Because translations historically are notorious for not just being translations.
They can be adaptations. A prime example would be Beowulf. Not a direct translation, but more than likely changed by the translator to be slightly more Christian in tone.
Well, indeed. So, and very often, if you study this, you'll find that translators have their own political perspective. And a great way to express your political perspective and get away with it is to translate something, because then you got plausible deniability.
That's right.
And so, Tyndale was eventually, about 6 or 8 years after he had published this, he was hunted for a long time, and eventually he published a book where he admitted that it was his translation, and he said that the reason why he didn't put his name on it was because of Matthew 6:1-4. He was following the admonition of Jesus to not blow his trumpet in the marketplace. Now, of course, that's a half-truth, right? The other half of the truth is that his life could have been forfeit if he put his name on it. And eventually his life was forfeit. He was eventually burned at the stake by Henry VIII. Only like, what, 2 or 3 years before Henry VIII became Protestant because he saw Anne Boleyn, right?
Yeah.
Crazy world. Crazy world. Our world is crazy, but in very other ways.
You couldn't make up the play about it.
quite.
And that's just it. The idea that these plays, especially the comedies, things like that, were reflections of the society around him, reflections of quite literally the world that he was steeped in.
Yes.
It's just fascinating. Fascinating. Yes. Once you really start giving it that forensic treatment like you have, which once again, when you're looking through a textbook, when you're going over a generalized curriculum that's been the same curriculum almost for a decade, with maybe a new edition of a book along the way or something like that, or a new annotation to a new edition. It can be hard to look at things in that kind of forensic way. Even when we were talking with Don earlier, he taught theater history, you know?
Yeah.
And the idea that, like, wow, I taught theater history, and these things never even, like, the history of the time and the theater history not being able to shake hands,
right.
Never even registered.
Right.
Never even registered.
Right. Because the truth is, I believe that you're trained as a Shakespeare scholar, or really as dealing with any part that could touch on Shakespeare, you are steered completely away from that.
Yeah.
And I saw that in my graduate experience. I was fortunate. I was in a comparative literature department, and I did the work I was just describing to you about Edward,
which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it produced my pursuit of this question produced a crisis within the university, because not everybody, but there were some people in the English department who were like, why are you letting your comp lit student study Shakespeare? That's our turf. Not to mention the fact that he's telling you a lot of nonsense because he doesn't accept, you know, our paradigm and our assumptions. So it did. And I was very fortunate because I had a number of professors, really most of the department in Comp Lit, who really supported me and saw the issue as one that required a more open-minded perspective.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's one of those, you know, Roger, the fact is history is truly so much a working hypothesis. Because it's written by the victors. Until you find the loser's manuscript, you know, you rarely get the other side of the story.
Yeah.
And that's a... that's a prime point to bring up and to wrap this up with, is the idea of you have to be both a student of history and a student of the literature of Shakespeare.
Absolutely. And you can go even beyond that. You know, one of the ways this has taken me is an interest in handwriting because, you know, I had this Edward de Vere's Geneva Bible. And of course, you know, one of the first things I did was to try to be sure that the handwriting in it was actually his. It was his Bible, but that is at least a hypothetically legitimate question. So I just start learning about, you know, what do forensic handwriting experts do? How do they do that? And that turns out to be relevant. You know, the Stratford man, six signatures is the sum total of his handwritten work that has survived.
Yeah.
And even those may not all be by the same person.
That's right.
So they have this horrible dearth of relevant evidence. We, on the other hand, have an overwhelming and expanding, you know, galaxy of evidence.
Yeah.
So we need people that are interested in all of these things and are willing to think in an interdisciplinary way and bring whatever tools are necessary to the table to try to get a better understanding of what really did happen in the past.
Absolutely, because it, like we say on the show regularly, I don't care if you're talking physics, I don't care if you're talking paranormal like we do regularly on the show, or even if you're talking this or history or lost history, research does not happen in a vacuum. It cannot just happen by one person. You've got to be able to share data. You've got to be able to have even a disagreeing conversation in an open mind, and you've got to be willing to kill your darlings. Even if you're the one that posed the hypothesis, you've got to be the one willing to put the shell in it to shoot it down, you know?
Yes.
Thank you so much for the conversation. This has been fantastic.
Chris. Yeah.
Let everybody know where they can go to keep up with your work, where they can go to buy books, where they can go to find more about the Shakespeare-Oxford Fellowship.
Okay. Well, the Shakespeare-Oxford Fellowship has a wonderful website. There is our sister organization in England, the De Vere Society, that is pursuing the same objectives. They have many very famous, Sir Derek Jacobi is one of their patrons.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of really famous Shakespeare actors are into this. And so when people say to me, well, all the experts say you're wrong, I'm like, you're saying that Derek Jacobi is got to be in the top stratosphere of Shakespeare experts. He's acted in almost all the plays, maybe all of them, some many, many times. And when you have to act those plays, you have to know them. Anyway,
yeah.
So the De Vere Society has... they have these impressive patrons. And my own website is called shake-spears-bible.com. And that includes materials on my the De Vere Geneva Bible research and a lot of the stuff I've been doing since then.
Well, I would love to have you back on again and again and again to talk about this continuing research because it's something as a theater kid, it is near and dear to my heart. The theater is why I do what I do for a living.
Yes.
And this has just like reignited my love for Shakespeare.
As it should.
Because
this is the sad part about the opposition to us, is that many of us are people who reconnected with Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
Because we thought, oh, wow, isn't this an interesting story? I wonder if it's true, and I wonder if you explore it as a hypothesis, can it teach you more about the works? And the answer in my experience is a lot.
Whenever I have this topic on my show, the turn of phrase I use is, it doesn't take a shovel, it only takes a trowel. It's just a scraping across the surface of evidence that will lead you down the rabbit hole, because there's not a lot there. There's no original complete manuscript. every manuscript in the folio is assembled from parts, most of them incomplete. Like you said, we have all of six signatures, none of which actually match
anything else from Avon.
Yeah. So, yeah, fascinating. Thank you so much again for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
It's been a great conversation.
Okay. While you are online checking out all of the great work of Roger Strittmatter. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of our episodes from this and other live events. Stay tuned through this quick break. We'll be right back with our continuing coverage of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference right here in Denver, right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO, UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Curious Realm's continuing coverage of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference here in Denver, Colorado. We have the great pleasure of being joined by Cheryl Egan Donovan. She is from Controversy Films and the creator of Nothing Truer Than Truth on Amazon. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
How did you first come to light with the Shakespeare authorship controversy, Cheryl?
Well, I was a British literature major in high school, and then I did independent study on Shakespeare and androgyny when I was an undergrad in college. And then I took a course, a history course at Harvard University with a professor named Don Ostrowski, who still teaches there. And his whole approach to history was about evidence, primary, tertiary, secondary evidence, and how do we know what we know. And so he asked us to write an essay, and he said one of the topics you might want to write about in that context is who wrote Shakespeare. And here I had been studying this for many years and had never heard
that
there was any kind of, you know, controversy. Yeah. So he recommended John Thomas Loney's book, Shakespeare Identified. Mm-hmm. I read that. Then I read Joseph Sobrand's book, Alias Shakespeare. And I said, wow, this guy is so interesting. I was convinced, particularly with the analysis of the poetry that Loney did, because I had written poetry as an undergrad. It was clear to me that this was the developing voice of the poet who would become Shakespeare. So I went from there. I did a little research. I said, this guy is fascinating. I would love to make a film about him. I had just finished my first film, which was about music. It's called All Kinds of Girls. It was about a punk rock band from Boston.
Yep.
And I found out that Margot Anderson and Roger Strittmatter were working on a biography of Edward de Vere. Roger was still doing his PhD at UMass at the time, and then they ended up splitting up, and Margot finished the book, Shakespeare Identified, and Roger went on to do his PhD analysis of the Geneva Bible that's at the Folger Library.
Yeah.
So I went to the book release party and introduced myself to Margot Anderson and said I'd like to option the book. And then I went to the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference in Ashland, Oregon, and had lunch with Margot, and we made a deal. So from there, yeah, I got the rights to the book, and that
was
great. Yeah. And from there, I started filming, and it was a long process, but I really enjoyed it. I loved it.
And at any point during that process, at what point did you come to the point? Have you come to a point of doubt about Shakespeare yourself? through the process of making this film?
Well, as I said, when I was introduced to Edward de Vere, I was convinced that he was the author. So I started from that premise, but I wanted in my film to allow people to kind of get there on their own. Mm. So what I did was, you know, show the parallels between the plays and his life, just as Margot Anderson had done. So I really used that book as a template, and I just focused on two chapters, really, that focus on the time that he went to Italy. So
sure.
Showing, you know, using film clips, which, again, was an expensive way to show, you know, the connections. But I felt that that was something that young people could relate to. Like, many of them are familiar, you know, with Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, mm-hmm. and also Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. So
yeah.
We used the film clips to tell the story of the parallels between de Vere's life and the plays. And then we did a Kickstarter campaign. We went to Venice and Northern Italy and filmed for 7 days. And that was really great. So that became the story arc. He leaves London and goes to Italy and, you know, discovers Commedia dell'arte, meets Titian, sees the plays in Siena of Piccolomini, you know, and he comes back with all these ideas about music and theater. And when the film ends with him returning to London, and then the first two plays that were produced right after he got back, Comedy History of Errors, which we believe is an early Comedy of Errors, and then Titus and Gisippus, which is an early version of Two Gentlemen of Verona. So that's where I left off with the first film.
Fantastic. And, you know, that is one of the topics that we talk about regularly on the show, is the fact that whether it's Edward de Vere, whether it's anybody else, it's the fact that the author would have had to have traveled. He could not have been somebody of just regular common upbringing, common ilk. You would have had to have been somebody of means to have been able to have that worldly kind of travel, because the locations in Romeo and Juliet, the locations in, you know, Merchant of Venice, things like that, they are actual locations.
Exactly. Yes, that was what was so fun. I was able to interview Richard Roe before he passed, who wrote the book Shakespeare in Italy, you know, who had gone to all of these locations and photographed them and wrote a beautiful book about that. But, you know, other wealthy, as you said, aristocrats did travel to Italy. And so, for example, there was a book that came out a few years ago about Thomas North. He traveled in Italy. Someone talked at the conference today about Philip Sidney having gone to Venice, you know, so other people did go to Venice. But the things that de Vere puts into the plays as Shakespeare are so specific. They're during the time period that he was there. And it's certainly not the kind of information that someone would get at the Merchant, at the Mermaid Tavern. And it's also, people sometimes say, well, he learned all this from John Florio, but it's much more detailed than that.
Yeah, yeah, and even the ideas of Romeo and Juliet, where they met, things like that, the way that the families operated, you would have had to have had an intimate knowledge of such things.
Right, and I mean, the great thing about Shakespeare is that he uses so many different sources and his own life experience. So as a writer, you know, that's what I find fascinating, the way that he can take these archetypal characters and these great classic works, because Romeo and Juliet, for example, is based on a myth of, you know, a real pair of lovers in 13th century, I guess it would be Verona, that you know, tragically had this same thing happen to them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the early poem of Arthur Brooke, Romeus and Juliet. But he also puts in his own experience, and that's what makes it so rich, because, for example, his men were fighting in the street with Anne Vavasor's family, her brother and her people. So it seems so closely related to, again, things that happened in his own life, not just other sources.
What were some of the other things that you came across that, I guess, kind of changed the way, that changed the lens through which you view Shakespeare as you created this film?
Well, I think one of the things that really interested me was what Loney just identified as his conflicted attitude toward women, and which Solbern writes about extensively, about the sonnets, you know, and the fact that it appears that the author was bisexual. And many, many Stratfordians have said that. And I found that that was a really important part of you know, the way he creates his characters, the strong women that he gives us, the, as I said, the androgyny that I was interested in when I was in college writing about that. But I did find a lot of resistance to that theory. And so that was surprising. So one of the things that opened my eyes was that, you know, that experience of getting some pushback on that.
Well, and, you know, it's fascinating. I can see where you might get some pushback on that from people. But when you start looking at older societies, when you start looking specifically in royal courts, things like that, it was not an uncommon thing for a man to have a young lover. Things like that. I'm not saying it's okay by any means. Believe me, audience. But well, I can hear my audience
going
now.
Going back
like,
to Plato's
gross.
Time, it was perfectly acceptable.
Exactly.
So it depends how far
you go back. And that's just it. It isn't until our modern time, really closer to the Victorian era, things like that. I mean, even that was one of the things that John Adams got on Benjamin Franklin about, was like, my God, you're torrid when you're over there in France. Mm. And Benjamin Franklin was like, I don't think you understand how French politics works. If I'm not betting these women and doing these things, we aren't going to get anywhere, because that's how French society works.
Well, that's a great analogy to when De Vere went to Venice. So when he went to Venice, I did some research about what was going on there, and it was really kind of the last frontier. It was anything goes kind of place. It still is a little bit. And so, you know, not only the dressing up for carnival, which allowed you to mix with the different
classes because
in disguise, but people actually played the roles. And, you know, the female prostitutes dressed as men because that way they could get the male clients who were looking for someone. So it's really fascinating when you look into the time period that he was there. You know, he did... he was known to a famous courtesana, Virginia Padawana. And so when you find out, you know, about his experience with, when he was there, it's really fascinating. And I think it would have been something he was interested in, and it certainly informed his work.
Now, during the creation of this, how long did it take you to research the film before you started filming?
Well, altogether, it took me about 10 years to finish the film, but I was doing research as I went. So I think, you know, I'm making a new film now, and that's, I'm trying to finish filming this year because I'd like to, you know, get it out.
Back to
next,
back.
Right, get it out next year, have it ready in time
on the
for festival
tales.
Deadlines. Yeah, and so I've been doing research, though, you know, since the last film was released, and I've been going to the libraries and archives in London and the UK and doing my own research on. In this film, what I'm interested in looking at is his theatrical career. So Edward De Vere as the center of the theatrical world in late 16th century London. A lot of my work and my inspiration for doing this research and making this new film came from Alexander Waugh, who's a brilliant researcher in the UK, who helped me a lot with this. But he has a theory, you know, that De Vere was at the center of the world at that time. The theater world had a whole group of writers working for him. And by the end of the 1580s, the early 1590s, when, coincidentally, you know, the name Shakespeare first appears, he's gone broke. And at that point, the other actors and businessmen, you know, Allen, Henslow, and Burbage take over the theater scene. So I said, I love that story arc, and I want to, you know, do more research on that. So I've been looking at all the manuscripts that support that theory. And then I wanted to tell the story of Edward De Vere's development as a playwright and theater maker, and the parallel story of the development of Elizabethan theater in London and at the universities. So that's what we've been filming for the last year.
Wow. Wow. And what kind of release date are you looking at
now? I said, if probably 2026, because if we can, you know, we have to finish filming for the most part, unless we do a little pickup or something, and then editing, and then get it in time for festival deadlines next year.
All right. So. Two-part question. Mm-hmm. How has your film been received by this community, by the Oxfordian community, and how has it been received by the standard theater community, the fans of who we know as Shakespeare, the man from Avon?
Mm-hmm. Well, this community, the Oxfordian and the authorship community, has been completely supportive, totally supportive, and I could not have done either film without their help and support. So many of the great scholars that are here appeared in the film, and so many other people helped, you know, by contributing to fundraising and giving me access to things. You know, I found my composer through someone who's here. You know,
oh, wow.
It's all about connections. My distributor was through someone who was introduced to me by an Oxfordian in Washington, D.C. So I tell people all the time, you know, the connections that you make with people are so important. That's how you get to releasing the film.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But in the general audience, I mean, the film is doing really well. When I premiered in Harvard Square at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge in 2018, you know, we had a great response. People really loved it, people who had never even heard of The Question. And as I said, I think the fact that it's still doing very well online indicates that there's a lot of interest.
And no kickback from the English studies communities or the theater communities?
What's interesting is that many people have participated in the film whose jobs would preclude them from doing so. So they were very kind of cautious and said, I'd love to talk to you about Shakespeare. I know what your film is about, but just don't ask me to make that connection. Like, don't ask me to say
that
Oxford was Shakespeare. So as a result of that, it was wonderful. I got to interview Diane Paulus, who's the director of the American Repertory Theater.
Wow.
She's fantastic. I love her. She's a really great expert on Shakespeare herself and a great theater director. She's just terrific. And then Tina Packer, who is the founder of Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Mass., and she was wonderful. I mean, she's just such a great speaker. And she talked about what we were talking about earlier about men and relationships in London. She said, well, I just think, you know, Shakespeare went to bed with whoever was to hand. And then she laughs at her very hearty laugh, you know. So it was great. And she talked about Shakespeare's women. So all of those things were wonderful to have a few Stratfordians. A few I asked would not do it. Stephen Greenblatt just said no to me again the other day.
It can be hard to get some of them on screen to talk.
But he always has a great excuse that he has a new book coming out. You
sure,
know, he's
sure.
a very prolific writer. And, you know, I've talked to him a lot about it.
And the reason I asked that is because, you know, I come from a theater background. And one of my favorite things is whenever I release episodes about this, I'll always hear from one friend from college that was in theater, like, really, Chris? You know, and I find it interesting that those that you did interview that were from the theater community were like, yeah, I will talk about this, but I will not say that this person was the author of Shakespeare, because, it's a big thing in the theater. I think much more in the theater community than in the actual English studies community. I think quite a few people in the English studies community might be interested in the concept, may even be interested in the forensic deep dive.
Analysis.
But I think it's more the theater community that is really guarded with it.
There's a standard response is it doesn't matter, we have the plays.
Yes,
but then I have to give credit to two people who have been super supportive for this new film and of the last film, and that's Sir Derek Jacobi and Richard Clifford, who's a great actor and director. And they have been terrific, you know, and they talk about the fact that it doesn't change the way you perform the works, but it's fascinating. So, for example, Sir Derek studied history. He's fascinated by the history,
It gives you a different route of the work. When you have that different route, when you know that this joke that's happening isn't just a joke, it's an inside joke. That this is an inside joke between these three families in the royal situation. You know, like this Duke's family, that person's family, and this person's family, and they all have this infighting. And unless you were involved in the business of the royal families, you would not have known that. The common person may have chuckled, you know, because the situation on stage, but they wouldn't have known the deeper meaning of that. Knowing that deeper meaning of that gives you a different way to deliver the performance.
Right, and I think it goes back to, you know, a couple other things that Derek talks about in my first film, and that's, you know, the fact that the plays were first performed at court for an insider audience who didn't know what the references were. Only later were they then performed at the Globe, for
precisely.
Example. And the other thing that I love that, you know, Derek's been really great about being very open about is that, you know, he thinks clearly the sonnets are love poems, and that, you know, that indication is that the author was bisexual. So, you know, he made no bones about that. You know, was very clear about that.
Yeah, talking to the other side of his sexuality, basically.
Right. But the academic community does push back on that, you know, unfortunately.
They say,
well,
that.
Yeah, they say, well, actors don't, what do actors know? Well, I think actors know a lot, so it's a little hypocritical that they say that.
Well, you know, and you know, it, as a creator yourself, why do you think it's important that we find out, Cheryl?
That's a great question, because that's how I started my first film. As a writer, I think it's essential, because I teach writing, and I've been writing for many years. We do write from our own experience, absolutely. We have to be discreet, and we combine lots of people to make characters, you know. But we also have to have access to books, and the access to the source material, it's just not there for the guy from Stratford. It doesn't exist. No. He did not have access to the books.
He couldn't have read them.
Many of the books in the original languages.
That's right.
And
that's
then,
right.
Lastly, it's about revision. You know, it's revision, revision, revision. A great writer, you know, doesn't just spring full born from, you know, the head like Athena. So
that's what
it takes a lot of work. Genius takes, you know, 10,000 hours. So those three things, I think, are important for students of writing. And as an educator, that's an important reason for me.
It is, it is. And, you know, that's something that you really have to consider. Like, I was just talking a minute ago with Roger, our last guest. I've got volumes of poetry that I've written, and it's interesting to look back at the beginning and then go back to the last thing I wrote, probably 10 years ago almost now, and see that progression, and see that progression myself as an artist, see that progression within myself as far as point of view. Good God, I wish I could have ever written outside of a first-person point of view.
Right.
That's some, even musically, it's something that I could never do. I could never step into somebody else's shoes and write another character. It's just, it's not how my brain thinks.
Right.
And I laud anybody who can.
That's a great point, too, because I did speak at one of the conferences about that. So with other poets, we do have their early work, and we can their growth. You know, Sylvia Plath started writing very young. One of her early poems
example.
Not very good. Her later stuff is fantastic.
You know? And
I also love the story of Arthur Rimbaud, you know, who was so prolific in such a short amount of time, you know. But there are lots of analogies. But the other reason that it's important to me does have to do with the way that he represents gender and sexuality and, you know, respect for everyone. He's very much aware of the other and differences. And I really think, I mean, I developed a separate curriculum called Shakespeare for Bullies that addresses, you know, that using the plays.
Interesting.
I really think it's important to understand, you know, that Shakespeare isn't just some old white guy.
No.
He was somebody who was, you know, really ahead of his time.
Even when you get into Othello.
Yes.
Like the... Right now, Denzel Washington is getting ready to, and I cannot wait for that to come out. It's going to be so incredible.
Right? Yeah, that's going
to
be great.
But to see modern interpretations of that, and even see how that situation was treated in Elizabethan times, is a very distinct window into that royal culture, into that background of culture that existed in a strata above everyday society.
Right, but I do think, as I said, Shakespeare is unique in that he really took advantage of the origins and the, you know, basic premise of theater, which is disruption and misrule and, you know, turning those roles upside down around. That's what the theater allows for. So it allows for, you know, to play different genders and to play different class people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he just really embraced that, and that's what makes him unique.
Yeah. Now, with films like yours out there now and with the new one coming out, how do we broach this topic to new generations? How do we, I guess, other than shows like this and things like that, how do we get this word out there? How do we begin to open the dialogue, Cheryl?
Well, I do think that through the media, you know, there are people doing, you know, Alexander Waugh's videos are on YouTube, and Phoebe Near's TikTok videos are really great, you know. But again, as an educator, we find that students are very open to it. So I really think it's a matter of the next generation. They're interested. The high school teachers are really interested. Roger and Shelley and I went to a conference a few years ago, the National Council of Teachers of English Conference. We talked to thousands of junior high and high school teachers who were so excited about the authorship because it's a different way approach telling Shakespeare.
Not that I'm not a fan of Shakespeare, friends, but it's a much more interesting way to study Shakespeare.
Right, because the knee-jerk reaction a lot of times is like, oh, Shakespeare is so boring. I hate Shakespeare.
And it's also
hard to read.
Where is the background? Mm-hmm. Where do you start? Like, you start with a pseudo-history. You start with a little bit about the man from Avon. But once again, we can broach the topic of, or is he?
Right.
And introduce that idea. So it's great that you are out there doing this with film because there's, as you know, as an educator, some of us learn with our hands, some with our ears, some with our eyes. And if you can engage more of those, so people like you doing film and making things like this engaging really do bring a beautiful new aspect of media to this hunt for the true authorship of Shakespeare. So
that's my hope.
Absolutely. Well, let everybody really know where they can go to find out more about Controversy Films, where they can go to watch the movie, where they can go to see the trailer for the new one and keep up with everything that you're doing.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. They can go right to my website, which is www.controversyfilms.com. And there you can find links to the full-length film, which is still, as I said, on Amazon and a bunch of free streamers now. And then you'll find also the trailer for the new film, which is called All the World's a Stage.
Fantastic.
So, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for
really
the time on this, quite honestly, very busy Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference. When I walked in, I do conference AV for a living, and when I walked in, you never know what to expect with a topic like this. It is fantastic to see such a full room of people that are so catalyzed by the conversation and so involved in the conversation and question asking. It's fantastic. So thank you so much
thank
for coming
you.
And being
Thanks
here and
for
presenting.
Joining us.
While you are online checking out everything from Cheryl at Controversy Films, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. It's where you can find all of our interviews with guests like Cheryl and others. Make sure to stay through this quick commercial break. We will be right back with our continuing coverage of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference right here in Denver, Colorado, right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Curious Realm's continuing coverage of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference here in Denver, Colorado. We have the great pleasure of being joined by a friend of the show and researcher, Catherine Children. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for coming.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me out. It was great to make connection with the fellowship and come out here, talk to all kinds of folks. You're actively going to be presenting here in a little while. Let's get into your presentation a little bit for the audience.
Yes. Well, it's about some images of the 17th Earl of Oxford, who I believe is the real Shakespeare. And I've been researching portraits for him for a very long time. And in fact, I did find one, a 1581 portrait of an unknown gentleman that I have identified as Oxford, and it's on the cover of my book, Shakespeare Suppressed.
Okay.
And so that fired me up, and then I found actually documentary evidence that that really was Oxford, in the sense that the hat that he's wearing in this portrait reflected a gift that Queen Elizabeth gave the Earl of Oxford.
Oh, wow.
Yes, after he was released from prison. And it's of the same description, so I think that that pretty much proved it.
Interesting, interesting.
Yeah, and that roused me up as far as finding other portraits.
Well, and, you know, that's just it. There is so much when it comes to forensic evidence, like you're saying, things like that where portraits can be traced back. You can go back and trace the origin of these things and find these tiny little clues that kind of lead you down the rabbit trail of, that gentleman that we know from Stratford-upon-Avon is not the man that we know as Shakespeare.
Right, definitely. He William Shakespeare was someone's pen name.
Yeah.
And there was just so happened to be a man with a similar name. And actually, the name was never spelled like the playwrights. The two got confused. And he was also involved in the theater, the Stratford man.
Mm.
So I wouldn't deny him an association with the theater, but there is absolutely no lifetime evidence that he was educated or was a writer or wrote anything.
Well, and you know, that's something fascinating that we brought up in numerous interviews during this conference, is the idea that there's no growth pattern to Shakespeare. He just suddenly is. There's no, like, hey, here's early works that really aren't that great. You know, here's some sketchy stuff that is just notes, that kind of thing. There are no preternatural writings. There's no beginnings of poetry or anything like that.
No juvenilia, they call it.
Yeah, juvenilia.
Yes,
there
you go. He just bursts on the scene in 1593 with this incredible poem called Venus and Adonis. That was the first work under the name of Shakespeare in print. And this shows somebody who was not inexperienced, very experienced author, writing in a very difficult rhyme scheme. I believe it's called Rhyme Royal.
Mm.
So he had to have other pieces of poetry to his name, but we don't know. He just bursted out in this brilliant writer.
Yeah, because iambic pentameter is not exactly something that's easy to write in to begin with. It's really kind of a style all its own. So the idea that this is really the first place that it came along and it just came out of nowhere,
right,
is kind of strange.
And also in the dedication of Venus and Adonis to the Earl of Southampton, Shakespeare writes that it's the first heir of my invention. And many people say, oh, this is his first poem.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. What he was really referring to is his invention is the pen name, William Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And this is the first
heir to it.
So he was really explaining himself, actually, pretty out in the open, even though the name is a pen name.
You know? That's fascinating, and that's really interesting to think about. Now, when you going to things like Hamlet, y'all went to a performance of Hamlet last night. One of the things we've been talking about is the idea that many, many Shakespeare plays, whenever you go see them, things like that, are not in their entirety. Because of their length, because of their drawn-out length. So they're edited, they're changed, things like that.
Yeah, necessarily, because if you look at the more or less final versions, which were in the folio, the 1623, if you did them, perform them, they would last 5 hours or more if you did every single scene and every single speech.
Yeah.
So very likely these final printed versions were something that the great author was working on toward the end of his life and enhancing and really turning it more into a piece of literature than as a play.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that we got into with Don here at the show was the idea of even modern theater. You know, if you go, like, I'm a huge fan of 90s Broadway theater and the idea of even a show like Les Miserables, where scenes are changed, songs are changed. They're changed annually now so that you're encouraged to come next year because we're going to have a different mix of songs, you know? So when you're talking about especially a lot of the things like the comedies being written specifically for the royal court and then performed later, the idea that it wasn't like, hey, here's your 300-page script. It was, here's your part. Here's your part, here's your part. And if this was changed for, let's say, a secondary performance at the royal court or another one, and then changed again whenever it came to the public stage, come assembly time, all those things were probably just put together, and that's why we have a 500-page manuscript instead of what they typically just performed.
Yes, I would agree. It's something along those lines of what happened.
Yeah. And, it's really interesting to see a kind of almost a revisionist history point of view, you know, just the idea of people's misunderstanding of that, of the fact that these, even with the folio, they were assembled. Nobody came in with a completed document and said, here's Hamlet in its entirety.
Well, exactly. And that's why I say that, have we really read the Shakespeare plays as the author wrote them? Mm. Because clearly the editors of the first folio did not have the original manuscripts, even though it says on the title page, you know, that these are the pure originals. That's not true. Nobody, no scholar today will tell you that that was the case because there's so many mistakes and so many strange passages ghost characters that are named but don't have any parts, things like that.
Well, and bumps where things just don't weld together within the story and within the scenes.
I think many of the plays are actually reconstructions of actors' parts or people sitting in the audience doing stenography and then giving them to printers, and maybe they didn't hear everything right, but the mistake carried on.
That is a great point because, once again, printing was extraordinarily rare and expensive at the time. So to have all of this printed out, once again, like, hey, here's your 300-page script, here's your 300, it wasn't really the case, you know. They were working off short sheets, that kind of stuff, you know, crib note type
things. It's my dream that one day the original manuscripts will be found all together.
Wow.
Because, you know, we don't have one page of a manuscript in the author's handwriting.
Yeah.
So I think they've been collected and maybe squirreled away somewhere.
You know, that is one of the active theories of Oak Island.
Yes.
Catherine, is that the original writings of Shakespeare are down there. And wouldn't it be fascinating if that is what they found?
I would love it.
You know, it would be interesting. But even then, it's the idea of, good God, why go dig a hole like that to hide the works of Shakespeare?
True.
You know, and even then, that brings the conversation of, why not change? Why the consternation in theater, in academia, all of that, you know, that when you're looking at, well, it would be ridiculous to dig a hole and put everything in there. How come nobody wants to put a ladder in the hole and come out and have the conversation about the rest of it, you know?
Right.
It's pretty fascinating to see both didactic sides of that conversation.
So, right.
Yeah. It's just one of those strange things where it's like, wow, this is... I don't think it would be anything that would greatly and hugely change history as we know it, you know?
You mean digging up what's down there? Or
even revealing who Shakespeare is.
Oh, yes.
You know, like, I don't know. If he did have a a tryst with the soon-to-be Queen of England and did impregnate her, then yeah, the actual crown itself as it stands right now wouldn't be the crown that should be there. You know, so there's kind of that,
theoretically,
I guess,
but
in theory.
400 years have passed, so yeah, I don't think it would really be a threat.
Things would have been changed along the lines.
But for example, I often bring up the idea of Polonius being Lord Burleigh, who was one of the most powerful men in England at that time, during Shakespeare's time. And he was not portrayed in a flattering way in Hamlet as Polonius, as the counselor of the king.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's still a Cecil family today, and maybe, you know, they might be adversely affected by the truth coming out, this may have been a portrayal of their famous ancestor,
and the
founder of their family.
That's one of the things that I've brought up pretty regularly here at the show, is the idea of, I can understand hiding it at the beginning, because you're talking about not necessarily defaming the name of some of these people, but they were definitely inside prodding jokes that if somebody else came up to that point, they'd be like, oh yeah, remember that dude that wrote that thing? We need to go find him real quick.
Right.
You know? And all of his family who's living on that land, they just need to go away now. You know, no more vassals for them. Titles are stripped. Land comes back to the kingdom now. And I could totally see that happening in early England. I could completely see that happening if somebody who was made fun of in one of those scripts.
Well, also, there was the succession that was of interest, too. And if you look at the Shakespeare sonnets, many, including myself, believe that the young man, or the fair youth of the sonnets, was the queen's child. By the Earl of Oxford. So, that's my personal opinion. I think that's what many of the sonnets are all about, the succession. And when the sonnets were published in 1609, a lot of nobles were not happy with the new king, James. He had been on the throne about six years. If it were known that the true author of the sonnets, and this was published under the name of William Shakespeare, if they knew that that was really the pseudonym of a nobleman who was in the know, who was very close to the queen, and that they could read into the sonnets that this fair youth was really the queen's child, and maybe he is somebody eligible for the throne. So that would be another reason to hide.
Yeah. Yeah.
The true identity of the author.
Precisely. Now, you're actually working on new research right now for a new book. Let's dive into that for the last few minutes.
Well, I'm not really going to talk about it, but deeply, because finished.
I don't want you to give it all away.
But
either.
I think it's where art and the Shakespeare authorship kind of come together. And so I'm trying, that's what I'm going to do.
And there was a whole presentation in there about things like that a while ago, about paintings and their significance to the world of William Shakespeare and how they were inspired by it, and things that they may, like you were saying, the hat in the image that you're talking about in the beginning of the interview that, you know, can be traced back as a gift from the Queen of England.
And there's also the Ashbourne portrait, which is now at the Folger Shakespeare Library. That shows a man holding a beautiful jeweled book with his hand, one hand on his wrist on a skull. And so many people, whenever the portrait was discovered in the 19th century, since then, a lot of people thought that this was a portrait of Shakespeare, and an allusion to the sonnets, which would be the jeweled book.
Sure.
And then his wrist resting near the skull would be an allusion to that scene in Hamlet.
Yeah.
Where he looks at York's skull and talks about death.
Exactly.
So, the portraiture is very important. And in my talk today, I am going to bring up a few other portraits that I think are Oxford that most people are not aware of.
Well, tell our audience about those a little bit.
Well, one is a painting of a young courtier dressed in a beautiful courtier's outfit, and he's opposite of an aged man, and below them is a skeleton. And in between them are Bible verses. I mean, it's a really fascinating picture. And back in the 80s, somebody commented, an auction house, that it resembled the Earl of Oxford, the young man. So that really got my attention. Yeah. And it turns out that there are at least five versions of this picture. So
interesting.
And then you look closer at the picture, and it looks like these figures are standing on wooden floorboards with fancy framed signs that are on nails. So it could be a man on stage.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
This may have been a theatrical production.
Interesting.
Involving the Earl of Oxford,
Interesting.
And the earliest known version, they date to circa 1575 when Oxford was in his 20s. So
wow.
Yeah,
wow,
so this is a very interesting thing.
That is fascinating. And we know that the Earl of Oxford was, a patron of the theater.
Yes.
We know that the Crown was a patron of the Earl of Oxford.
Well, yeah, at least from 1586 onwards, he received a £1,000 a year annuity from the Royal Exchequer. So that was very significant.
Yeah. Yeah, and one that wasn't really to be questioned or looked into,
right.
according to the grant of the grant. Like, don't worry about what this does, just give it to him. And it's pretty fascinating to hear that.
Well, I think it had something to do with also maybe compensating him for all the plays at court that he provided. Like in 1577, I believe, there was a play called The History of Error. And that was before the Queen and her court. Well, we also have a Shakespeare play called The Comedy of Errors, right?
Yeah.
So that's just one example. There are many others that I wrote about.
How frequently, at least from what we see with things like that, how frequently was the court commissioning pieces like that to be done? Were they commissioning pieces for other reasons, just for entertainment? What were these commissioned pieces for?
Initially they were paid for by the Queen, the production, some of it, but it was the Earl of Oxford writing for it, and I don't think she was paying him for doing that, so I think that subsequently ended up in the £1,000 grant. But also, as you were alluding to, there are some plays that do affect patriotism.
Mm.
And also the history of England. So I think that those were eventually performed before the public with the intention of making people proud of England.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah,
I
think the same way we put out movies in the same way.
Yes, yes.
I'd love to say propaganda doesn't exist.
Yeah.
but it does.
It's a very long history.
And it's there. Exactly. Yeah. It's nothing new. And that's what I think a lot of people don't realize is like... There were plays in ancient Greece that were propagandistic, talking about the enemies and, how to treat them and things like that.
But if you ask the typical English professor, they'll say, he was just writing for his meal. He's writing for, bums on seat.
Yeah, yeah. No. Yeah, just to bring the people
in. Just to bring the people in.
And, with that being said, we have a few minutes left. How do we begin to, I guess, turn the tide? How do we begin to shed light on this? How do we begin to have these academics that naysay all of this begin to actively, just look at actual historic fact?
Well, they won't. Unfortunately, they're really entrenched in their point of view, and I've been in this almost 40 years, and there's been no real change. So I think it is really beholden to the general public to, start clamoring for answers, clamoring to these people who are the gatekeepers of Shakespeare and shows. That's why I'm on shows like yours.
And that's why I love having you on.
Yes, because we need to get the average person involved. And, there's been a great misjustice here for someone who wrote probably the greatest literary works that were ever written.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So he deserves justice.
Well, and, you know, it's also that fact of, I think right now in our society, it's very interesting to see this almost, it's not even a gap, it's almost a generational chasm when it comes to things like this. And being able to, I think that there's some great hope that as older professors move out and those that are my age become professor and that kind of stuff, those in their 40s, 50s are moving into those positions of tenure. I'm hoping that there will be a seed change, that there will be a want to look at things with new eyes through the actual lens of history. You know, just the common sense lens of history. Things like, okay, so a commoner in the 1600s was able to read and write. Noted.
commoner with no education.
With no education, with no...
Right.
Yeah.
No court connections.
And that's just it. You know, there's things like that where it's like, wait a minute. It's kind of the same way I feel whenever I talk about the Great Pyramids on the show. It's like, I love Egyptology. But if this was a tomb, where are all the religious scriptures that are supposed to be all over the wall to get the king's soul to the stars? Without those religious scriptures on the wall, this is a big box to hold his soul here and to never let him attain the afterlife. Because there's a like magical spells from the Book of the Dead that are supposed to be there for his spirit to come out and read so his heart can be weighed against the weight of a feather. Those are nowhere in the Great Pyramid. So Egyptology is telling us without these things, a king goes nowhere. Nobody's soul goes anywhere. But yet still you're telling us it's a tomb. And the two just don't jibe. They don't shake hands. They don't add up. And much like, okay, so you're telling us this guy who apparently never released anything before this first amazing poem just woke up one day, knew how to read and write like that.
Yeah, well, that's essentially what the professor's telling us.
Yeah.
That it was really, really like automatic writing, you know, it came from a spirit or God.
Yeah.
And he just wrote it down.
Yeah, I know, precisely. And it's one of those like, wow, you couldn't ask for more spectral evidence. quite literally spectral evidence.
Yeah.
Because it's strange when history doesn't match up like that. And even talking with Don yesterday on the board, who was a theater history teacher, you know,
yes.
He was like, the day that it hit me that, wait a minute, none of what I'm teaching in theatrical history about this actively matches up with history.
Yes.
There's something totally wrong there.
Yes. Yes.
So, yeah, to see, I've seen more than one young person here, more than one person in their 20s, things like that. So the fact that this is being looked at, being courted by people of that age, I think gives us a great deal of hope for the fact that this research will continue, it will go on, because that's something that I bring up at a lot of conferences that I go to. How do we move it into the next generation? How do we bring what has literally been a library of research and research done in a library, things like this, to the digital world, you know, so that it's not only accessible, but so that, you know, the internet was not made for cat videos. Catherine, as much as I love my show, it wasn't even made for that. It was made so that people could share data. It was made so that academics and labs could in real time share data, because research does not occur in a vacuum. Even research on vacuum science doesn't occur in a vacuum. Like, you have to have other researchers. You've got to be able to bounce ideas off people. That's why conferences like this are massively important.
Yes.
Massively.
And that's why we need, you know, to constantly bring in new people, younger people. That's what drew me in, because I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
And I saw that most of the people who came to conferences were like in their 60s or older. So I kind of felt that I had an obligation,
and,
you know.
I always akin it to, I'm a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, and I always akin it to whenever I walk into a Knights of Columbus hall somewhere that doesn't know me, and they're like, oh, look at this young buck. Somebody buy him a beer so he stays around. And it's like, hey, I'm 49. I think it's the next demographic that you want to be bringing in.
Yeah.
Not necessarily me at age 50, where I'm like on your coattails. Like, you want to bring people 20 years younger than me in,
yes,
you know,
yes,
so that this research continues to continue and so that they can invigorate the other youth to get into it, to check it out. You know, it's been great to, as you know, we talk about a lot of really strange topics on this show, but it's been very interesting, even since we've started the show, to see the attitudes towards many of those topics change in society.
Yes.
And in science. So I have hope that in my tenure of this show, that the attitudes toward this will begin to change as well.
Well, I think you are helping in that process,
and I
do hope it happens.
Absolutely. Yes. Same here. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can, A, go to get your book, other than our store, where they can go to find out more about the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, and where they can go to follow all your research.
Well, for my research and to read the introduction of my book, Shakespeare Suppressed, you can go to shakespearesuppressed.com. It's also on Amazon. People can also write me, and maybe we can make an arrangement. But I also encourage people to go to the ShakespeareOxfordFellowship.org website, and also I'm a member of the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition, which is the website doubtaboutwill.org, and you can read the Declaration of a Reasonable Doubt about the Stratford man being the great author, and you can sign a petition. So
awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time
while we've been here.
It's been a pleasure meeting you in person.
Wonderful meeting you in person.
Something other than Skype. While you are online checking out everything from Catherine Children and the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, as well as doubtaboutwill.org, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share. That is where you can find all of our live coverage from great events such as this. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, things like this, things like the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, do not happen. The conversation doesn't move forward. And without that, humanity doesn't move forward. So that wraps our coverage from the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference here in Denver, Colorado. Everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.